When you think of music in North Carolina, you might think of old-time and traditional mountain music, but you may be less likely to think immediately of classical music. One North Carolina composer who has successfully used traditional music in a classical setting is Robert Ward. In the background now, you're hearing his Cloggin from Appalachian Ditties and Dances. Living now in the Triangle, Robert Ward continues to do what he loves, compose. Two new CDs of music by the composer have just been released. Robert Ward shares some of his music and memories from his experiences in the Second World War to his years as president of the North Carolina School of the Arts in Winston-Salem with WUNC's Keith Weston. Ward says classical music remains a relevant and important part of our culture.
Well, it plays a large role in, of course, a lot of our institutions, the church. We have several thousand symphony orchestras in the country today, to say nothing of all of those in universities and colleges and schools. We have bands. We have a thriving world of opera and ballet. All of these are basically using what we call classical music. Mm-hmm. Now, they're mixing it up these days with things that come out of the pop field, but classical music has always gotten mixed up with things out of the popular music of its day. It goes way back to the 13th, 14th, and century, where, for instance, most of the composers of that time wrote a cantatas on what was a popular song called The Western Wind. And so there's a history of this. And I think that the early part of this century was almost the first time in music that you had a complete break between so-called popular music and so-called classical music. I, for one, am very glad to see that breaking down, mm-hmm. because much of the classical music, which has been written in this century, I think, is not communicated very well. And it's not a question in some cases of whether the music was good or bad, but it simply is short on those elements which communicate more easily to a large public.
It's something that has been criticized of, poems and literature and much of what was produced in the first half of the 20th century.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Words are a much more immediate kind of thing. Their meanings are clearer and so forth. And, you know, in the back in the 20s and so forth, when we had some of the writers who would litter their works with quotations in Latin, foreign language, God knows, Chinese, anything you want, you'd find it there. And they were catering to a very elite kind of group of people. And it was very dense. It was very difficult to understand. And so for a few years, that sort of thrived. But now, even though you read about James Joyce and T.S. Eliot, mm-hmm. and some of the writers of that time, people write about them, but you don't read the poetry very much or the prose very much. And so I think it's taken music longer to get through that, because it's always been abstract, basically. And I think that's what's happening in these past 10 years or so, that composers are beginning to feel it's a good thing when they communicate with their audience.
Echoes of America by Robert Ward. This is from a new CD called Echoes of America, which is a piece that I believe was commissioned by the Raleigh Chamber Music Guild in 1997 for your 80th birthday.
That's correct.
Much of it seems to be rooted in music that you've encountered throughout your lifetime. There is hints of Moravian music from perhaps your time in Winston-Salem as president of the North Carolina School of the Arts. There's a little bit of folk music.
That's right.
Jazz music, perhaps from your time in the Army as a leader in a jazz band during your military time in the Second World War. Tell me some more about the sources of inspiration for this Echoes of America.
Well, you've mentioned really just about all there were. But the other thing which always means a great deal to me is the particular players that I'm writing for. And actually, this was the first time I had ever written for the clarinet outside orchestra and band and so forth. And so that was a real challenge. But this combination is a wonderful one and in itself was a kind of stimulation. Actually, the title was suggested by Jimmy Gilmore, the clarinetist, because after they received the piece, he said, you know, this is so American, and it reflects all of these aspects of America. And I said, well, indeed it did. But that's been a kind of criticism which I have received rather regularly over my life. Maybe this is because I never went to Europe to study, as so many people did. At the very time I might have been getting Fulbrights or going overseas on a Guggenheim Fellowship or something like that, it seemed my wife was always having another child. So we never did get there. Later, I spent various amounts of time in Europe. But my formative years all came out of the music I heard in this country. Of course, that included symphony orchestras and operas and chamber music. But it also included the fact that when I was growing up in the 30s, one of the great events was to go to the new first-run movie, and they would show the first-run movie, but along with it was a stage show. And these stage shows would have the Glenn Miller Band or the Benny Goodman Band. Then when I got down here to North Carolina, we had a place in the mountains up in the Sparta, where we attended various kind of folk music festivals up there. So all of this has sort of worked together and came out in this piece.
Now, you used the word criticism. It's sometimes been a positive criticism as well, that your music tends to reach out to people. It's not aloof. It's not necessarily theoretical, as so much of 20th century music has been. When you're composing, is that something that you're keeping in mind, playing? Well, I don't mean this quite as it sounds, but playing to an audience?
No, I'm never conscious of that, except that I am conscious of the audience I'm writing for. For instance, if I'm asked to write an orchestral piece for a particular kind of occasion, then I think about the kind of audience that will be there and try to reach them. After all, music is nothing if it doesn't communicate, and that's a two-way street, so I think one always has to be aware of that.
On the new CD, Echoes of America, which is also the name of the piece that we composed, it's played by a triangle-based group called Aurora Musicalis.
Yes.
Now, this is a recent work from June of 1977. Could you think back for just a moment to the very first time you remember taking out a piece of lined paper and applying notes to it? Now, it may not have been your first published work, but I just want you to think back for a moment. What do you remember about these early attempts?
Well, my first attempts came out of the fact that I came from Cleveland, Ohio. And at that time, the public school music in Cleveland was certainly some of the best in the country. And my background had been singing. I sang in choirs and musicals and so forth while I was in school, and everything that I could do in church. And then when I got to the high school, they had two very good years of harmony. So I thought, I'm interested in that, mm-hmm. so I took these courses. And, of course, the first things I did were to write exercises for those classes. But then out of it, I had a very wonderful teacher there who also gave us kind of creative projects, and that was the beginning of my beginning to compose.
I'm glad that you brought up the topic of education, because it's something I wanted to get to, since your career has been so entangled in education throughout the years.
Right.
As president of the North Carolina School of the Arts, as an instructor, professor at Duke University, what do you think, how important is musical education and where should it begin? Is it something that preschoolers should be involved in? Is it something that we need to concentrate more on in the public schools and private schools?
Well, I feel that very strongly. In the first place, I had the advantage of experiencing very good public school music. And my life was very definitely affected by the fact that you remember when Sputnik came along, the education system just went crazy. They decided everything had to be math and science, and the arts were the first thing that they shoved off into the outside school hours. They no longer supported it with the number of teachers and so forth. It was just at that time that the North Carolina School of the Arts was founded. And when I was first approached to come there to be the president, it was something I thought a great deal about because, on the one hand, this was very good for my creative career. On the other hand, my children, and I have five, were all in high school or junior high school at that point, and they were all interested in the arts, and suddenly there was very little there for them. So I decided that this was a wonderful opportunity to do something for music education, and that was a strong factor in our deciding to come to Winston-Salem.
And that was in 1967.
67, that's right. So, but before that, of course, I had taught for 10 years at Juilliard after I graduated. And then I had been a music publisher for 10 years. Now, music publishers, particularly the one that the company I was involved with, which did a lot of choral music, had to be interested in schools. So I had contact all the time, even though I was supposed to be in the commercial world.
I better be hearty soon.
Out of here.
I better go in the dark.
Out of here, Tituba. Out of my sight.
This is the State of Things on 91.5 WUNC. Now, Keith Weston continues his interview with North Carolina composer Robert Ward.
I want to talk a few minutes about how you've used plays throughout the years as inspiration for some of your works. I know that you've written work based on an Ibsen play.
Yes.
And then the most famous probably is the Arthur Miller Crucible from
1962,
which won the Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah.
What are some of the special considerations when you're adapting a play to a musical setting?
Yes. Well, of course, the first thing is whether I find in the play those things which I think will shape up into a powerful musical setting. And every one of the plays that I've dealt with does have exactly that those qualities. But after that, what it comes down to is that with my librettist, we have to cut the play by about two-thirds, because the number of actual syllables in a libretto, which gives you something about the same length as the play, is about one-third. But finally, you bring it down to something which has the brevity of a libretto, but it has other things as well. It has to have those moments when you can let go with great set pieces, as they're called in the lingo of the field, where an aria or a duet or a trio or a chorus, whatever it may be, is very appropriate for the moment and is a piece that has its own structure and it stands alone. Mm-hmm. And so one looks for those moments in the play and moments when you can make them into an aria or a duet or what have you.
What was it about the Arthur Miller play, The Crucible, that initially drew you in and said, this is something that needs to be adapted?
Yes. Well, it has extraordinarily strong characters, and every character in it has their own kind of profile. They aren't minor characters in the sense of this is just someone who walks on carrying a spear or something. Mm-hmm. They're real people, and what these real people are involved in confrontations all the time, and that's what gives you the sense of drama in a play. Beyond that, there was the sort of the ambience of this play, which was very fascinating, this tiny fishing village on the coast that was ruled by a theocratic church state, as a theocratic church state. And the several characters in it who represent the kind of integrity of real morality as opposed to the bigotry which was involved with the heads of the state in that case. And this was very fascinating to me because having grown up during the 30s and gone to school into the 40s and then having been involved in World War II, those times gave one a strong sense of social responsibility and sensitivity toward the social conditions. And, of course, Miller's play grew out of exactly that kind of situation.
It had some relevance to what people have called some of the witch trials of the 1950s as well.
Well, it was very interesting. Last January, the Washington Opera did a performance, and the review of it had a headline. And remember, this was January in Washington. The Crucible, the best witch hunt in town.
No, it is a natural lie to tell. I beg you, stop now before it is too late. Do not condemn another innocent. I beg you.
From the award-winning opera The Crucible by North Carolina composer Robert Ward, who joins me today. I want to ask you also about another, world premiere that's on another new CD that's come out, and that is By Way of Memories.
Yes.
And here we are again with memories. Is this something that is populating your mind at this time in your
stage?
Well,
at my not-so-tender age... I think most people, when they get to their elder years, tend to look back on memories. And this particular work came out of the fact that the National Gallery of Art was commissioned, I think, 5 composers to write works for the celebration of their 50th anniversary. And so George Manis, the conductor, called and asked if I could write a work for him, and I said, sure, I'd like to do that. And he said, and I said, what kind of a work do you want? And very often they want something kind of razzmatazz. Mm-hmm. And but he said, well, you know, he said, I'd, I'd like you to do something that was rather different than that kind of piece. He said, we'll probably get one or two of those anyhow. But he said, you write wonderful slow movements, so if you would like to do something of that kind. And I said, gee, it's good news, because I've written my share of celebratory pieces. And I started out to write a kind of nocturne, which is what the piece is. And when I got toward the end, I found myself remembering a song I'd written many years before, which had this phrase, by the way of memories. And the piece reflected feelings that I had about early times. And so I took the title from that. It comes from a James Joyce poem, as a matter of fact.
Now, you mentioned Celebration. One of the pieces that we often play here on WUNC is the Jubilation Overture,
right.
Which is a
right.
prime example of
yes,
celebration
that's
from,
right.
from a, what, 1945, was that?
It was actually written in 1944.
44.
And under rather unusual circumstances. I was in the 7th Division, which was one of the most active combat divisions in the Pacific. And the last two combats that we were in were on the Philippines, on Leyte. We were the first troops to land there, and then we were the first troops to land in Okinawa. And in both of these places, the band which I commanded was the division command post guard. So, in fact, I had quite a lot of time on my hands, and we had instruments around, and I had, piano was available to me. So, in the midst of rather macabre circumstances, because on two of these occasions, we were encamped right next to cemeteries, some of which had been blown up. And I remember one morning while I was writing Jubilation, looking down, seeing this thing that the more I looked at it, I realized what it was. It was a bone that had been blown out of a grave.
Oh, my goodness.
And but at this time, the European conflict was over. And we knew that all of the force that had been used there was going to be coming our way to finish the war in the Pacific. So that our mood was, we realized that if we got through the next couple battles, that we would get home. And that was really the feeling which dominated the piece. Also, though I had always loved jazz and so forth, I never really had anything to do with it in terms of writing or professionally until I got in the Army. And suddenly I found myself with a terrific swing band and a sort of a Guy Lombardo band and a Goodman Sextet, all in this big band that I had. And so I occupied myself a great deal with arranging for them and leading mm-hmm. this swing band. And this got into my whole music and has never left it. I mean, there's a blues movement in the Echoes from America.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because that was what I was going to get around to next, is that it comes up again in one
right.
of your more recent works.
That's right.
So you have this 50-year span of or more than
right.
music, then still some of the same influences on
oh,
you
yes.
today.
Yes.
Yeah. Dr. Robert Ward, I want to thank you for coming in today.
Well, thank you, Keith. It's been a pleasure.
Robert Ward has recently finished a piece called Cherish Your Land for the opening of the new building of the Museum of Natural Science in Raleigh. He also has two new CDs. One is called Echoes of America, and the other untitled CD features his Second Symphony, Piano Concerto, and By the Way of Memories. You're listening to The State of Things. I'm Mary Hartnett. After the break, the story of a mother and daughter who form a special bond while dealing with a challenging genetic disorder. Stay with us.